This is KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond for Friday, February 6th. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, an update on the VPSO training to carry firearms in Western Alaska. The St. Paul Sea Parrots coach tells us a little bit about his short season and thoughts from our occasional essayist Clark Fair on the tug of war between access and excess in Alaska's backcountry. Outgoing Dillingham City School Superintendent Bill McLeod sits down with us for our Friday conversation. Those and more after this look back at some of the week's news. It's the time of the year governments are introducing budget proposals for the next fiscal year. At the federal level, President Obama is proposing a $4 trillion budget with spending increases across the board. That would include more money for the Indian Health Service, says Acting IHS Director Dr. Yvette Rubidoux.
So the fiscal year 2016 president's budget proposes to increase the Indian Health Service appropriations by $460 million to a level of a budget authority of $5.1 billion.
The president's budget with spending increases has met with resistance from the Republican-led Congress. In Alaska, unaffiliated Governor Bill Walker has proposed a rather austere budget, calling for $240 million in spending cuts and eliminating some 300 state jobs.
Probably the toughest thing that I've done in the last 2 months was presenting that budget. It's a tough one because it involves people's lives. It's services that are near and dear to our heart that we've gotten used to.
Walker says the state has a $3.6 billion budget deficit and is drawing $10 million a day in savings to make up for it. His budget now goes to the state's lawmakers. It was announced this week that a pair of men in Unalaska, acquitted of a second-degree murder charge by a jury last fall, will be retried in April on lesser charges of assault and manslaughter. Leonardo Bongolto and Denison Soria are accused of killing Jonathan Adams outside the Bering Fisheries bunkhouse in 2012. The Bristol Bay Forever initiative is constitutional. That's according to Alaska's highest court. The Supreme Court issued a ruling last Friday giving a final approval to the initiative, which was adopted by Alaska voters last November. Mining interests, including Pebble, had challenged the initiative, saying Alaska's constitution gives approval authority of resource development to the executive branch, not the legislative. In other news, the Dillingham Fire Department was called out Wednesday for the first time in several months. A steam bath on Cessna Drive had caught fire in the morning and burned. A crewman aboard the Northern Leader was rescued by the Coast Guard way out in the Bering Sea and safely taken to St. Paul. And the YKHC Hospital in Bethel reported that Yupik artwork worth thousands of dollars was stolen. So far, they have no leads. Last night, the Dillingham City Council met for its regular Friday meeting. Missing was Councilman Chris Maines and Mayor Alice Ruby. Presiding over the meeting was Mayor Pro Tem Tracy Hightower. I spoke with Councilman Paul Lieberg for a recap of some of the business attended to last night. Paul, thanks for taking the time with us here this morning.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Well, let's talk real quick about this ordinance that passed last night to update the city's sale tax to these folks that live outside of the city limits. I think this has been in discussion for a while, and the city council has now chosen to put it into effect. What are your thoughts on this added tax to the outside customers?
Well, I think what the ordinance did was really clarified how the tax is applied. You know, in this case, we were dealing with fuel sales outside of the city limits, and specifically in another municipality. So our code currently says that we'll charge sales tax if the business is located within the city of Dillingham, that we'll charge sales tax even for sales outside. But we didn't want that to apply to a place like Aleknagik that already charges a sales tax. We didn't want to double up on them. So what this ordinance did was clarified that if another municipality charges a sales tax for deliveries such as fuel, in this case specifically fuel, we're not going to add the whole Dillingham sales tax on top of that. So really what it did was exempted the 5% sales tax that Aleknagik currently charges and then just implements the one additional percent, the difference between 5 and 6% for the Dillingham sales tax.
So I gather that any customer that buys fuel from our fuel suppliers here in Dillingham will be paying a 6% sales tax no matter where they're buying it from.
That's correct.
Okay. Another resolution that came up before the council last night is this idea of opposing or supporting a nomination of the Aleutian Islands National Marine Sanctuary. It sounds like most of our neighboring folks down the chain have opposed, and as I gather, Bryce Edgman is working on a bill in Juneau to oppose this sanctuary idea, but the Dillingham City Council came to a different take last night. What can you explain what happened?
Yeah, in this case, NOAA opened a nomination process for these National Marine Sanctuary designations, and a group called PIER nominated waters in southwest Alaska. They called it the Aleutian Islands National Marine Sanctuary. So this resolution would have put Dillingham on record as opposing that National Marine Sanctuary designation. And in the end, the council didn't take action on it, didn't support that resolution, and didn't pass it. I guess there was a couple of reasons, probably. I don't want to speak for individuals, but I think a couple things that came out. This was the first time we'd really seen this proposal. I think another concern or thought that was brought up is that the nomination seemed to support many of the goals of the region, whether it's habitat protection or protection of subsistence opportunities or other things. And I think for those reasons, the council didn't take action to support this. And I just want to make it clear that we're not supporting or opposing. We just didn't take any action on the motion that was before us.
All right. Also, the city's attorney, Brooks Chandler, was on hand last night, offered some guidance on a couple of issues, annexation included. Maybe we can touch that another week. But of kind of critical time importance here is that marijuana will be legal statewide within the month. It's the 24th is the date. He said that municipalities have a lot of leeway in how they choose to move forward with this legal marijuana, mostly related to the commercial sale of it, which won't happen for another year. But my personal impression was that the city of Dillingham doesn't have any plan yet for what's going to happen on the 24th. Am I wrong, or do you see some need for some public input and city action pretty soon?
Well, I think the city needs to address it for sure, and I would just reiterate what you said. There's kind of two levels. There's the personal use, and then there's the commercial use. Personal use will be legal February 24th, and then it'll be a year or so before there'll be regulations in place on how we deal with commercial use.
Do you have personal preference on what the city might do here in the future? Any regulations you think are needed as a councilman?
Well, I'll say, first of all, that we did recommend that the issue be brought before the code committee, so it'll be discussed at the next code committee meeting, and I would really like to get as much public input as we can on that. So I would hope that people weigh in and help the council to come up with some recommendations if we need to have any additional recommendations on, first of all, the personal use, and then probably the bigger issue down the road is commercial use in a year.
Paul, let's leave it there for today. Thanks for filling in for Alice Ruby on her monthly chore here on KDLG, and appreciate it very much, sir.
Okay, thanks for the opportunity, Dave.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. This week, seven of the VPSOs from northern and western Alaska who met for regular training in Bethel began a process that may earn them the right to carry a firearm on duty this year. The new option, allowable under legislation sponsored by Bryce Edgman and passed last year, is due in large part to the death of VPSO Tom Adol in Manicotic. Ben Matheson reports for KYUK in Bethel and joins us now. Ben, you've been reporting on VPSOs and their potential training to carry firearms. What have you learned in the last week or two?
Dave, the first group of VPSOs will be seven VPSOs through the program to get towards training to carry firearms. Originally it was 21, but now there's seven in that course right now.
Ben, I understand there were more like 20 or 21 VPSOs who were initially sponsored by their community and had expressed interest in going through this program, but now just down to seven. What are the hurdles that have changed? Why is there less participation than originally thought?
They have run into some trouble with individual VPSOs making a decision that they may not want to be in a situation where they have to use deadly force in their village on community members, potentially family members. Also, some have struggled with the physical requirements of this. There's a strenuous involves running, push-ups, and sit-ups.
And these are the same physical standards that troopers are required to meet to get into the academy or something, I think. Is that not right?
It's one level of trooper requirements to get into the academy, and they based a lot of reports for this program off how they train troopers and what troopers must do to make it to that point.
Okay, so what happens from here before we see a VPSO carrying a firearm on duty in a village?
Right now, we're just through very extensive written psychological testing. There's plans for in-person psychological testing with the same doctor that deals with troopers. Ultimately, there's a three-member panel that's going to make a recommendation to the colonel in charge of troopers as to whether these seven make the training. That's 21 days of training in March at the Trooper Academy. They're using much of the same training they use for troopers, looking at weapons ethics. They're looking at different when you use deadly force and why, all sorts of simulations. And after that, there is extensive on-the-ground mentorship and observation with troopers that involves some in urban areas where the VPSO will travel and work with a trooper on the ground in an urban area, and also the troopers will go out to the home villages of these VPSOs and be there to be their partner, to be working alongside them as they begin to have firearms and use that as part of their job.
It sounds like there's much more down the road still ahead and just in the initial phases now, but we appreciate that update, Ben.
Thank you, Dave.
Again, that was Ben Matheson from KYUK in Bethel joining us here on Bristol Bay and Beyond. Back in a moment. Well, if you came to the Sockeye Classic Tournament last week, and many of you did, you might have noticed that tough team from the island of St. Paul. The six players, including one girl, are a tough team, quick, good ball handlers, intense, good shooters, but they're dealt a tough hand, too, tougher than most, with few, if any, home games, very expensive away games, and a short bench. Still, you probably saw that it didn't bother them much. I wanted to know a little bit more about them, so I spoke with their coach Michael Baldwin this morning, catching him between classes at St. Paul's School, where he teaches kindergarten and first grade. Coach Baldwin, talking to us from St. Paul, thanks for joining us on this Friday morning.
Thank you very much for calling us in.
Well, we were just, all of us were so excited to see your team here at last weekend's tournament, and I meant to follow up with you then, but you have got a spectacularly good team with only six players that have to, most of them stay on the court. They don't get a break, and they twist their ankle. They got to get up and keep playing hard, and they do. And it's really impressive to see. Tell me about this team this year. What are your thoughts about the team?
This team is a little different from the past. We've kind of really worked hard together. Last year, you know, I had the same team. I had one girl, and I had two girls last year, and so I had four boys, two girls, and this year I lost a girl and I gained a boy, and the chemistry is a little different, and we've been really struggling this year a little bit to find the same chemistry we had last year, and we've kind of pulled into the motto and the theory of family, just because we have to be with each other a lot of times and hang out with each other, and we're the only friends we have, and I kind of put it in their mindset that, you know, the person you play next to is the person that you'll know for the rest of your life. And, you know, who knows, they'll be there whenever time you need it. And one of my players kind of just says, hey, we're a family. And I said, that's right.
How many games will the team get to play? There was rumor that last weekend's tournament were maybe the first and perhaps some of the only games you had this year. I doubt that's true, but tell us what your season looks like.
Yeah, that's the way it is true. We have, of course, we have our little home scrimmages that we play against our local men. Our first game there in Dillingham against Togiak was our first game of the school year.
No kidding. That was the first game
yeah,
of the season.
Yeah, it was.
They're a month behind some of the other teams that have been playing since December. How did they show up in your mind?
We've played fairly well. You know, that first game against Togiak, we came out pretty flat, and, you know, a lot of it's butterflies and nervousness and things like that to work it out. We've been doing this for years just because of funds and the cost of flying. We don't get much traveling to go anywhere. In the past, you know, we'd go to Anchorage and play a bunch of smaller 1A schools that aren't even our region just to get some games, and from there we'll travel to our regional tournament. So each year we averaged between 3 to 5 games before we go to regionals. And this year we're going to get 6 games before we go to regionals. You know, the 3 we had there in Dillingham, and right now we're doing our first round-robin basketball tournament, the first tournament we've had since 1981 and 82. that we had more than one team here. Back in, I want to say, 1995, 1996, we had the Sandpoint boys come here. Then we did an exchange with the King Cove girls. And then 99, I believe, Kalinginik came here sometime in there, 99. So in retrospect, we really only had a 1A team here. Last one was a 99. And so, you know, it's kind of a struggle to get games, and that's what kills us a lot of times is the lack of experience. You know, a lot of guys getting, you know, 15, 18 games a school year, and we get six before heading to regionals.
It's just shocking to me that you look back on you look back in decades for when you've played teams last or when you had home games or whatever, and we look back in hopefully months or weeks for when we get home games here. We were sure excited to have you. When was the last time that the St. Paul Sea Parrots were at the Sockeye tournament?
I think it was last time we were there was 1990, the 95-96 school year. I think we took second that year against Sandpoint.
So it's been 20 years.
Yes.
With numbers so short on your end, six players, if you lose a few to graduation, boy, you might not have a team the next year. What's your outlook for next year?
Yeah, that's kind of been the scary point in the past 4 or 5 years. I'm always never sure if I was going to have a team the next year because a lot of students go to Mount Edgecombe and losing them to there. And I got four graduating this year, four seniors graduating. The next year I'll have two returning players. And then there's a big seventh grade group coming up. You know, there's probably about five, six of them that are basketball players, but they don't have a whole lot of experience either. And so, you know, I might not even have a team next year. And if I do have a team, it might not even be a traveling team.
Well, one more quick one before we let you go. We've been hearing about earthquakes out in between St. Paul and St. George. Feeling it on your end?
We were actually there in Dillingham when all that was happening. So we were kind of like, what's going on? And we haven't had too many since then. Nothing's been registered and nothing's been kind of coming up. So we're not sure what's happening there. Scientists and stuff were talking different stories that there might be a possible island coming up between us and St. George, possibly, you know, so who knows?
Well, hey, you'll get another team to play in 50 years.
Possibly.
Well, hey, Coach, we wish you a great weekend of basketball there with the Round Robin tournament and on your end, and we look forward to hopefully seeing some activity this year at regionals and maybe even at state. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much, too.
And Coach Baldwin told us that New Halen, New Stuyahok, and Port Allsworth are in St. Paul for the weekend tournament. Last night, as Sea Parrots beat New Halen by 13. Thanks for staying with us here on KDLG. For our Friday conversation this week, I sat down with Bill McLeod, who announced his resignation as Dillingham City Schools superintendent last month. Bill and Sherry will relocate permanently to Seattle, where Sherry is undergoing medical care for cancer. Bill, thanks so much for joining us here.
Glad to be here, Dave. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you sent an email out to staff in January announcing I don't know if it was unexpected, but your departure from the district. Bring those that didn't get the email up to speed a bit.
You bet. Yeah, it was unexpected. My wife went through cancer last year, and unfortunately it's recurred, and we've been going through medical care. And in talking with the doctors, one important question I asked them was, do I need to be with her? And they said, you do. So I had to make a decision to depart early this year. My intention was to finish the year and actually come back next year.
I wonder if you could share with folks how Sherry's doing.
Well, you know, given the situation, a third recurrence of cancer, she's holding up amazingly well. You know, it's serious. There's always hope, and we've really appreciated everything we've gotten from the community, the staff, our friends, our colleagues. And so we're holding that hope, and that's what people need to do when they get into these situations is keep your attitude as positive as you can, have hope and faith in that life will be good, and get the good medical care, and do everything you can to sustain what you have, and that's what we're doing.
You will relocate down to Seattle?
Yes. When we started our journey with this really 18 months ago, It was evident because of the seriousness of the cancer she had that we needed to get to the best medical care we could. And luckily that happened to be in Seattle at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance and the University of Washington Medical Center. And she's been under both those care of doctors and oncologists and surgeons since. And one of the questions, because we've been bouncing back and forth, and one of the questions we had to ask too was, does Sherry need to be down here full time now? And again, that answer was yes.
Let's move on to a different subject, which would be your tenure here with the district. Looking over these years, what do you consider to be some of the accomplishments or changes that have come with your time here with the district?
Well, I've been very fortunate. I think we've seen a broad range of accomplishments and improvements. And just like anything in life, when that happens, it isn't just one person. So these accomplishments are not necessarily just Bill McLeod. I've got a great staff. I've got great support people. I've got a great assistant superintendent. The community has been very supportive. We've had good partnering with all of the agencies in town, all the BBs, the city, SAFE. It's been a collaborative effort, and it's really been a neat journey. You know, one of the things that intrigued me about coming to Dillingham when the job was first posted, well, a couple. First of all, I love the fish, so you couldn't be in a better place, right? Second, I enjoy the outdoors. Beautiful here. Third, I was looking for a professional challenge. And when I looked at Dillingham, it wasn't a low-performing district. It had pockets of excellence, but it could be doing a lot better. And so I wanted that professional challenge in my life at that time.
Did this offer it to you?
It did offer it to you. I had other opportunities and was offered other jobs, and I selected to come to Dillingham because of those reasons.
Walk us through how you've looked at those challenges and tried to meet them.
Well, you know, I'll start with some kind of simple things. The bond issue had just been completed. We opened up the school. The elementary was just getting finished. And there were a lot of challenges in wrapping all that up, getting it ramped up. And everything was upgraded but the infrastructure of the school. You know, the HVAC, the mechanical, the pipes, the pumps, all of that. And it started to fail in year one. And so one of the things I feel very good about is with Russell Nelson and the capable folks that we've had, we have probably, at the end of this year, will have upgraded every significant failed system within the school district. And you never catch up with that because it's always recurring. But I feel very good with the state and condition of the school.
What about challenges with the kids, with the students?
You know, the kids here have been marvelous. Since day one, the kids needed to perform higher academically. That was one of the challenges that I saw. We had pockets of excellence throughout the system, but when I came, the district was on like year five of sanctions from the state for low performance, and there were mandatory compliance issues in the special education department, and I really have to credit Assistant Superintendent Danny Frazier. He came on a couple months actually before I did, and started working to really get the district in compliance, and he's done a terrific job with that. And since his tenure there, we had an audit 2 years ago. I think we were like 98% compliant, and that's kind of unheard of. That's a high threshold. And the academics of the school have really improved. I mean, we've went from that level five, which is the highest or lowest ranking you got at that time, to year something, because it started in 2000 and four, I think, was the year that everything started with No Child Left Behind. And so we've went from, at least from the state's perspective, of not a low-performing school, but we didn't do well enough to meet the thresholds to be a satisfactory or higher-performing school. Well, since the new, we put in a variety of initiatives for improvement. Our response to intervention program, we've updated the curriculum, we've did a lot of professional staff development with K-12, we've added reading interventionist teachers, we have intentionally worked on disciplinary programs and positive behavior programs for the students. And 5 years later, the tone and atmosphere of our schools is pretty positive. And when I first got here, I did hear a lot of negative comments from certain community members about how bad the school system was. And it wasn't bad, it just wasn't as good as it should be. I don't hear that anymore. I hear that we are a pretty doggone good school district. And with the new ASPE ratings, all of our schools are 3-star or above, which means we're satisfactory or better, and we want to even be better than that.
Speaking of getting better, or speaking of improvements, if you had another year or two or three, where would you set your sights, or where should the next administration set their sights to continue the improvements?
You know, one thing is with the whole fiscal condition of the state, fiscal budget is a real challenge now. We dipped in enrollment last year, so holding our enrollment and gaining enrollment is going to be kind of important, because the base student allocation formula that we get funded by is driven off the number of students. And when you're in an upward trend, life is good because you've got more money coming in. When you're in a downward trend, not so good. You have to start looking at making reductions. So just sustaining what we have right now is going to be a challenge. Another area that we need to continue to look at is to continue to improve our curriculum. Curriculum is a vibrant thing that is constantly in need of adjustment. And we have a very good cycle for maintaining our curriculum, and that needs to be continued, and investing both in professional staff development and in the kinds of materials that help kids learn better. We need to continue our intervention efforts that we've done with our response to intervention program, because that has been a key element of having additional expertise that the classroom teacher can partner and collaborate with, and provide that one-on-one small group intervention with kids that need it. And I believe that we should have a stronger career technical emphasis at the high school, and we should have developed curriculum on, or pathways, if you would, to real jobs in and around our area and in the state of Alaska, in adjusting the traditional high school format, kind of that college prep focus with maybe you have a spattering of career technical, to redesigning it where your focus is career technical. Think of the natural resource jobs in our area. Think of the marine fishing industry jobs that are in our area. Think of the health and related medical jobs and positions in our area. And districts, furthermore, that have done this also do better in another dramatic, well, not dramatic, but it really is a challenge for this area, and that's the dropout rate.
I was going to ask you, what can you say about the graduation rate since you've been here, and what do you see as the next couple of years down the road?
It has steadily improved. The dropout rate in the community has been as low as the 30%, and the highest it's ever been is 70%. We're estimating this year that this year's graduating class is going to be doggone close to 80% plus or minus. It will be the highest graduating class ever since they've been keeping records.
5 years, what's your proudest moment with this district?
Improving the dropout rate. I feel very good about that, because that is a difficult, difficult thing to change because of all the dynamics that are involved there. That's probably the best thing. The second best thing, I think, is generating a very positive image for the school district and engendering a very caring, kind, and collaborative staff. This is a good place to be.
Bill McLeod, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
And we'll end this week with an essay. Our friends Clark Fair and Yvonne Lutweiler supply KDLG with photos from places around our backyard that often leave me scratching my head, wondering how they got there. They hike, climb, bike, and ski when and where I would have thought the conditions wouldn't have allowed. Yes, most of us will get out on snow machines more when the snow allows. We're not really a hiking locale as far as Alaska's destinations go, with just a few handful of trails to get us started on. Here, Clark Fair shares some thoughts on the matter.
My father would have liked living in Dillingham. He would have enjoyed the absence of stoplights and Winnebagos and the low number of stop signs and roads. When I was in my early teens, Dad said, "When Soldotna gets stoplights, it'll be time to move." He failed to smile when he said this. About a decade later, Soldotna did get stoplights. But Dad didn't jerk up the tent stakes. He may have thought about it, but he didn't sell the homestead. He just gritted his teeth as the stoplights multiplied. Chalk it up to inertia, or entrenchment, or whatever. But he and Mom stayed put. Dad used roads, but they weren't a requirement for his happiness. Dad's requirements were more basic. Closeness of family, good food, meaningful work, a slow pace of life, and plenty of good hunting and fishing. In fact, Bristol Bay might have seemed like a paradise to him. Having been raised in a rarely changing, blink-and-you're-through-it Indiana town, which to this day still has no stoplights, he simply was no big fan of rapid progress. He liked his development at glacial speed, and he favored narrow country roads, trails were even better, and plenty of mountains and water and wildlife. Although he preferred human power over mechanized power, he didn't eschew the machine. If Dad had lived in Dillingham, he'd have owned a jet boat, and he'd have befriended pilots. But he'd also have hiked the hills and fished the streams and slogged up the brushy drainages in search of moose and ptarmigan. He might have bemoaned the relative dearth of good hiking trails and may have worked to encourage increased access to the backcountry, but he wouldn't have allowed poor access to diminish his outdoor spirit. He'd have driven Snake Lake Road and hiked the four trails there, Warehouse Mountain, Snake Mountain, China Cap, and Nunavagaluk Overlook. He'd have boated across Alegnagik Lake to climb the Jackknife Mountain Trail and any other trail into the high country that he could find. And he'd have reveled in Wood-Tick-Chick State Park with its gorgeous, rugged peaks and ridgelines, awash in amazing fishing and hunting opportunities. Although he disliked snowmobiles, he might have bought one anyway just to expand his range. Or, perhaps, like me, he'd have owned a pack raft, a mountain bike, cross-country skis, snowshoes, and whatever else he could strap onto or slide over his feet to improve his human-powered progress. In the end, of course, Dad stayed on the Kenai Peninsula, with its road system, its motorhomes, its crowds, its stores that pleased my mother, and its easier access to the backcountry. But it's up to each individual to decide which is better. All that access and the excess that goes with it, or more restricted access but less of the hustle and bustle. In Dillingham, Dad would have found ways to escape to the wilderness. And, contrary to our history in Soldotna, he would still be waiting for the first stoplight to appear. Now, Mom, on the other hand...
Some trails are happy ones, others are blue. It's the way you ride that trail that counts. Here's a happy one for you. Happy trails to you.
And thanks to Clark Fair for that essay. Well, that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Send us your feedback, story ideas, poems, songs, and essays to news@kdlg.org or to me at dave@kdlg.org. You'll find this week's show a little bit later today on our website. Thanks for joining us.
About the clouds if we're together. Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Till we meet again. Happy trails.